on May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Online Great Books. If you've made a goal for yourself to read the great books of the Western world, but have had trouble following through, check out Online Great Books. It's an online platform. You sign up. They're going to mail you a physical copy of the book that you're assigned that month. They're going to provide you a reading schedule and send you reminders on how you should read so you can keep pace. Then at the end of the month, you're going to have an online video seminar where you can discuss the book with other people in your group. So if you want to learn more about this, go to onlinegreatbooks.com. And when you're ready to sign up, use code AOM at checkout. You can save 25% on your first 3 months. Again, onlinegreatbooks.com, code AOM at checkout, save 25% on your first 3 months.
All right, here's a question for you guys. What does it mean to be gifted? Right, you probably, if you're like most people in America or in the West, you probably took some test when you're in elementary school that was used to determine whether you were a gifted student. But what exactly was that test measuring? And second, I mean, is that test really useful in determining, you know, the future performance of a child well into adulthood? Well, our guest today has been studying this most of his career. His name is Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. He's a cognitive psychologist, and his most recent book is called Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined. And he takes a look at sort of America's, in particular, obsession with determining whether a child is gifted or whether an adult is gifted, and our obsession with IQ exams. And, you know, he looks at what exactly are we measuring when we're taking IQ exams. And he also challenges the idea that, you know, we shouldn't just use IQ exams to determine the future prospects of a child, especially. It's a fascinating book. It's particularly interesting if you're a dad, because you might have kids who are taking those tests that you took when you were a kid. And whether they get into the gifted program or they stick with the average kid, that can have a profound effect on the rest of their life. So we discuss all this in the podcast. It's a really interesting, interesting one. So stay tuned. Well, Scott Barry Kaufman, welcome back to the Art of Manliness podcast.
Thanks. I love chatting with you.
I actually think you're the first like repeat guest we've had.
On two very different topics.
Yeah, for those of you, Scott, we had Scott on the show like early last year with Glenn Gear.
Yeah, that's right.
Wrote Mating Intelligence, the co-authored book called Mating Intelligence, about what research says about what people find attractive in one another. Fascinating book, fascinating podcast. I recommend you check it out. But today we're going to not talk about love and sex. We're going to be talking about intelligence, just like not just mating intelligence, but like intelligence, like IQ stuff. So Scott,
that's the question though.
That's the question though. Yeah.
What
is intelligence? So yeah, Scott, your book is Ungifted and the subtitle is Redefining Intelligence.
Wait, the book itself is Ungifted?
Yeah, it was a horrible book.
That's the title.
Yeah.
Title of the book.
Title of the book. Ungifted. Subtitle.
I mean, maybe the book is Ungifted. I guess that is for you to judge.
No, it was a great book.
Cool.
So it's just, you take on this idea of intelligence, like what it is, how we measure it. It's very comprehensive. But I want to start off talking about your personal history, because you inject that into the book throughout, Right. And basically your personal history seems like it's a lot of it's with the impetus and what inspired the book and sort of your research and intelligence. But it start off like you have just an extremely impressive resume, graduated from Carnegie Mellon, fellowship at the University of Cambridge, PhD from Yale. You've taught at NYU. You've written, you've started a book, a successful website called The Creativity Post, published several books. And what's crazy too, guys, listen to this. He's only 34 years old. So he's done all this in a short amount of time. Well, just not a short amount of time, but just like very early in his life. But what's funny is you talk about in your book is if someone looked at you when you were in elementary school or middle school or high school, they would probably wouldn't think, no, Scott's not going to do any of that stuff. He'll at best, be working some sort of mindless corporate job, at worst, maybe working in retail. Can you talk a bit about your childhood and adolescence in terms of schooling?
Sure. I think that's exactly right. And I would even go so far to say that even if you still measure me by traditional metrics, you would not be able to predict what I'm actually doing. So that's the paradox I've been kind of like spending my whole life trying to solve. My early childhood, I had a lot of ear infections the first couple of years of my life, and I developed a learning disability called central auditory processing disorder, which made it very hard for me to process process auditory input in real time. I mean, I would just kind of like zone out in the daydream in the classroom, and because it was hard for me to keep up to the auditory lectures. And of course, from the outside, that it looks like I was dumb, right? I mean, it looks like I was not understanding anything. It was just very hard for me to process it in real time. And I eventually outgrew, or maybe, maybe you never really outgrow these things, how do you tell anymore, but I compensated so much for these things that by fifth, sixth grade, I think that I was yearning for more intellectual challenges, but I was still in special education and they wouldn't let me take more challenging courses that I wanted to take. And really a lot of my early childhood, I had to kind of fight to display to people what I was capable of. And that was a lot of my early childhood.
So how did you make that leap from, being put in special ed and being seen as sort of on the slow track to doing all this impressive stuff? Was there a moment that like sort of things sort of shifted for you where someone saw, like an adult saw, hey, this kid's got potential? How did things shift for you?
Yeah, I don't know if they saw potential, but they saw my frustration. There was a teacher in ninth grade. I was kept in special education all the way up to ninth grade, and I had to keep in mind, I had a lot of catching up to do once I eventually left special education. But I was sitting there in ninth grade, and a teacher who had not been there prior to that day, she was covering for the regular teacher, she saw that I was like so clearly frustrated. I was like looking out the classroom across the hall, the biology class they wouldn't let me take. And I was supposed to be taking an untimed history test, and I clearly wasn't paying too much attention to it. She's like, what's going on? I was like, well, I have the rest of my life to take this test since it's untimed. Yeah. So what does it matter? And she took me aside, and she after class outside the class, she said, look, why are you still here? Have you thought about, trying it, without special education. and I was like, whoa, like no one's ever like questioned. No, I mean, it's something I intuitively wanted, but we spend a lot of time in our youth, accepting authority, right? Accepting, kind of like the judgment of others. And this was really a pivotal moment in my life. She really, caused me to question, whether or not I was capable of more. That I intuitively felt as though I was capable more, but it kind of empowered me to take a stand. And I didn't report to special education. I didn't report back, and they let me out on a trial basis.
Yeah,
I put that in quotes. But I went from like a CD student to straight A student, and it's amazing the power of having something to prove.
Yeah,
that can be a great motivating force in itself. And I was just like so determined to prove that I. Could do something that someone would describe as intelligent.
Yeah.
I did tried all sorts of identities. I did all sorts of stuff. My grandfather was a famous cellist, and he was retired, and I was like, "Will you teach me how to play cello, Gramps?" And he taught me, and I joined the school orchestra. I did choir. I did plays. I became a Latin scholar. I tried lots of identities. I'm not going to say I was good at all these identities I tried, but the exciting thing is that I was just given that freedom to try different identities, which I didn't have that freedom prior to that moment.
It's interesting. It was funny as I was reading that, like I related to that quite, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who read this and they're like, I relate to that. You know, while I wasn't like placed in like special ed, I was just sort of like on the average track, right? Because of the standardized test you take, you know, the Iowa test of basic skills or whatever. And I remember being really frustrated because I had friends who got to go to like enrichment hour, right? And they got to do cool stuff, like learn about Greek architecture. And I was like stuck, like color, you know, color by number stuff. And I remember like just being so like frustrated about it. I'd go home and like, you know, research this stuff on my own because I wanted to like, I wanted that experience. But because, you know, this test says I wasn't ready for it, I was denied that. And like, it wasn't until like middle school that I had just an English teacher who said, you know, I think you should be like on the honors track. And if like, it weren't for her, like I would like it because of that lady, like I was like seen as the honors student now. Like I was every class I got, I was honors and like things just really went up for me after that. But it was just like, I just remember being just completely frustrated that I couldn't do this stuff because a test said I couldn't.
That's right. We spend so much more time limiting children than offering them opportunities. It became so clear to me in my childhood, and I don't think we're that far changed today.
Yeah. Okay. So based on your personal experience, as well as your, you know, your own research, as well as, you know, just years of research on the topic, you make the argument in your book Ungifted that how we define intelligence isn't very useful and that we need to redefine it. So what's wrong with how we typically look at intelligence?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a lot, you know, even since this book has come out, my ideas have not changed, but have morphed in nuanced ways. The thing that I think that I wanted to emphasize in Ungifted is I'm not trying to distort the idea of intelligence out of, you know, and completely redefine it in my own way so that like I come out on top. You know, it's like, it's not like a personal vendetta to like, I define intelligence by the ability to do whatever Scott Barry Kaufman's good at. What I'm trying to really do is change the way we assess it or judge it. First of all, I would like to stop judging people's intelligence at any one moment in time. But if we absolutely must, what I argue in the book is that there's two conditions I think have to be met at a minimum. So I don't think just administering an IQ test in a 2-hour, you know, give you a 2-hour snapshot into a person's ability to on the spot come up with problem solve in a very decontextualized, impersonal way that's not at all interesting to the test taker. I think at the very least, if you really want to judge what someone's capable of intellectually, you have to, one, activate them or make sure that they're activated, make sure that they're engaged in what they're doing. This is something that interests them. You have their attention. You have their full attention, their full brain power. And second of all, you need to give them a heck of a lot more than 2 hours to display it. You know, you need an extended period of acquiring expertise, acquiring mastery, and really cultivating a deep learning process. And I think that it's a very superficial, narrow way of judging someone's intelligence in a 2-hour decontextualized testing session. So that's the major point I wanted to make. But I actually I don't think we need to distort the idea. I think intelligence intuitively means something to people, and I think it's an uphill battle trying to just completely say no, intelligence means something completely different than you ever thought it meant. I don't think that's the best strategy moving forward. I think we can think of, you know, intelligence as sort of the capacity or the ability to learn, to have knowledge, to acquire, the ability to acquire knowledge. You know, these are things we intuitively think of as intelligence, but I think that so many more people are capable of displaying those capacities, those abilities in much more extraordinary ways than we give them credit. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And that kind of leads me to my next question, because it's about the history of IQ testing in the West. Because that's you devote a lot of the book to that. And part of the problem, the problem with how we look at intelligence is the way we test for it.
That's my major beef, yeah.
Yeah, and it's with IQ tests. And like, it's just a really fascinating history, how IQ tests, how they got their start, and how they become sort of almost this, it's almost like we treat like astrology. Like, you take this test, and it's like, this is going to define you and predict how you're going to do in life for the rest of your life. But, you know, are IQ tests really that useful? And, like, what exactly are IQ tests measuring? Because I found that very interesting. Like, you know, what are we measuring when we take an IQ test?
That's a great question. And I've been, you know, part of my scientific research in the past 10 years has been really trying to understand what exactly is IQ measuring, these tests measuring. I really want to pinpoint, narrow down exactly, and kind of put limits around it. And what I basically come to the conclusion is that they are measuring a set of intellectual functions that are things that we would reasonably want to consider in the intellectual domain of things like memory, right? I mean, if as you grow older, you know, you have to admit that your memory declines, right? Mm-hmm. You can't be in denial about reality. Like, this is something that is important for our lives. You know, short-term memory, working memory, your ability to simultaneously hold various things in your head and process and try to integrate them to come up with make an inference, right? That's the hallmark of reasoning. Human reasoning on the spot requires a working memory capacity to be able to synthesize things. Your ability to vocabulary, you know, what is your vocabulary? What is your reading comprehension? Can you read things quickly and then understand the gist of what you're reading and understand? So all these cognitive functions, I think we can admit belong in the domain of intellectual functioning. But I think that the problem is when we use these tests to judge what someone's capable of achieving intellectually, or what they're when we use it as a measure of potential, mm-hmm. that's where I see mm-hmm. the problem coming. So Alan Kaufman, I'm not related to, but we have the same last name, and in 1979, the same year I was born, again, probably pure coincidence, wrote this seminal book that I feel has been grossly underappreciated called Intelligent Testing. Not intelligence testing, intelligent testing. He was a student of David Wechsler, who created the Wechsler tests of intelligence. And he argued that we need to use these tests we can use these as a tool to understand a student's patterns of cognitive strengths and weaknesses. You know, oh, the student clearly is a much better reasoner when it comes to spatial information than verbal information, or much better, you know, at verbal analogies than short term memory, things like that nature. But he argues that they should be used for that purpose, not the purpose of measuring some sort of innate intelligence, but using the testing to inform some sort of specific goal, like, oh, maybe this person is not performing well in school. Use it as like a problem solving process. You know, if a student comes in, you know, and you're a school psychologist and the student is doing poorly in school, there's a whole bunch of reasons that could be the case. And one of the reasons may be that the child is under-challenged and is not being given a chance to accelerate at the pace that they require, or as well as a whole host of other reasons. And I think that an IQ test battery can be used among a lot of other indicators. School back, you know, family background, the environment the child grows up in, the teacher support, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I argue for a holistic assessment of intelligence. That's really what I'm arguing for, is a holistic assessment that takes into account so many factors in the problem solving process. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And I guess I imagine why we haven't, like, as in the West or in America, haven't done that. It's pretty complicated to do a holistic view of a person. I mean, it's pretty easy to use a test to say, okay, this person's potential. So we'll use this as some sort of filtering. Cause that's what we use the IQ test, or different types of IQ testing. It's the filtering device.
That's right.
Like
sorting device.
A sorting device. Yeah. Like, I guess an example from my personal life, like, I guess the LSAT, right, to enter into law school. is sort of an IQ test. It's testing for reasoning, a specific type of reasoning.
Correlated with IQ, the global IQ score like 0.80, yeah. Very high.
Yeah. But like we, I lost you.
Hello?
Hello. Hello.
Hey.
Hey, we got disconnected.
We just accidentally got disconnected. Yeah.
That's okay. We're still recording, so it's fine.
Great.
But I remember like that's used as a sorting device. And like, if you don't score, like universities, law schools use that. If you score within a certain range, like you're not going to get into that law school.
That's right.
But what's interesting though, is that I've known students who'd like did very poorly on the LSAT, not very poorly, but like just bad enough or good enough they can get in, but they went on to have very successful careers in the law because maybe they weren't great at taking the LSAT, but they were good at other aspects or, you know, other aspects of the law that's, I guess, more important. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. It does.
Here's a question too. Like this is, I don't know if this is even related, but you know, I just read this, that you know, there's studies that show that IQ tests in America have been going up. Like there's like some kind of effect, right? Isn't there a name for that? Like why? I forgot.
It's called the Flynn effect.
The Flynn effect. Yeah. What is the Flynn effect?
Yeah. So it turns out that like if our great, 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 great grandparents were alive today and took an IQ test, their IQ their exact score would have a very different meaning today than it would have when they first took that test. It would be much, much lower. Their IQ score. And you have to understand the way IQ is, and to understand what I really mean by that, you have to understand how IQ is calculated. IQ is not like weight or height. There's no, you know, it's an arbitrary number. It's a number that's purely relative to other people in the population. So gotcha. If you're alone on a desert island, your IQ, you have the highest IQ in the world as well as the lowest IQ in the world.
That makes sense. Okay.
Your IQ is meaningless. What you do is you go out there and you measure your IQ. You administer a test to like thousands of people. And then your particular IQ score is how well you did in comparison to all these other people. And it looks like over the course of the 20th century, people have been performing better on these tests. The standard has risen on this test. So that what would earn you an IQ of, let's say, 120 in 1900 would now, you know, be like in the mentally disabled range.
Mm.
And that's the paradox that is does that mean that our great 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 grandparents were all mentally disabled?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no. So then the natural question is, well then are these tests even meaningful, right? So it raises a whole host of questions. It does seem like IQ has been rising.
Interesting. All right, here's the question, like for me, and I think other people will be interested, because like as I was reading this section, I was having a hard time getting my mind around it. But like you talk about general intelligence.
Yes, yes, that's the very thorny.
Yeah. You
know, in a very like easy to understand way, you can, you know, IQ, which is just an average score amongst a whole wide range of different cognitive functions. Is almost perfectly correlated with the general intelligence factor. So you could just think of general intelligence as IQ.
Gotcha.
General intelligence itself is a statistical method. You know, that is actually quite sophisticated, requiring something called factor analysis, where you look at how do all these tests relate to one another, mm-hmm. and you see that people who are good at one test tend to be good at the other kinds of tests. And people who do poorly on one test tend to do poorly on other types of tests. And you can kind of figure out statistically what's in common, how much, you know, is in common across all these different tests, and then rank people on how well they are in what's in common across all the tests. But that's a very sophisticated way of just saying it's a rough, you know, estimate of the average efficiency among a whole bunch of different of these cognitive tests, very similar to the physical fitness test you take in high school or middle school, right? You can come up with a general fitness factor, which is just basically your basic average efficiency across all sorts of things, like putting your chin up on the you're running the 500 meter down. You take all that, you put them through the hoops in 10 different ways, and then you just rank people in one dimension, which is their average efficiency across all of it. And that's all the general intelligence factor is.
Gotcha.
But it is complicated. I mean, it's hard to describe that to the general audience, because it does involve quite sophisticated statistics, and there's so many debates.
Yeah, that was the thing. Like when I was reading it was like, yeah, a lot of statistics, which I never took in college. But okay, that helped kind of clear things up for me. Here's another question I have. I mean, maybe this goes to whether IQ tests are useful or not. Take my example with the LSAT. I'm familiar with that because that had a big effect on my life. I remember when I first took my first practice exam, like I scored like a 142, which like would not get you into law school. Okay. This is like the first time I ever took the LSAT. But then like after like 3 months of intensive practice and study, like I was able to get that score up to like 165, which could get you into some really fantastic, you know, some really high ranking law schools. And I ended up scoring like a 160 when I actually took the exam. And so like I got better at it. Like I improved my, I guess, IQ in that reasoning, that area. But like, I know if I were to take the LSAT today, I don't think I would do that well. Cause like I've been out of, like, I'm out of practice. Like, so, I mean, is IQ testing, can you sort of like practice those skills and then like do well for that IQ test, but later on in life, you know what I'm talking? Do you get where I'm going with this?
I mean, it's a very contentious field, is how much can you train IQ versus the specific abilities that are measured by IQ tests.
Yeah.
So, and that's a very contentious, hot field right now. I told you, like, on IQ tests, there's like seven or eight different general, like, specific abilities that are mm-hmm. measured, from like reading comprehension to spatial visualization ability to a bunch of cognitive abilities. And IQ is just the average of all of that, right? Well, it looks like it's a lot harder to, and IQ, the IQ itself does fluctuate across your lifespan. So it can change. But it really is fairly stable, relatively stable across our lifespan. What seems to be much more amenable to change are those specific abilities that involve practice. So, you know, luminosity has, you know, or CogMed, right? They train specific functions like working memory. Mm-hmm. And evidence seems to be much more clear that working memory can be improved than that general global efficiency. Now, with the LSAT, that's a very interesting point, because there is a recent study that came out where they looked at the effect of LSAT training on the brain over the course of a couple months. And they found, first of all, they found that people on average jump from like the 40th percentile to the 70th percentile. Mm-hmm. So clearly that training helped a lot, but also their brain connectivity between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe, which we know is really important for attention and focus and executive functioning.
Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. My favorite feature on Rocket Money is finding those unwanted subscriptions. If you're like me, you have a bunch of those things you signed up for but forgot about, streaming services, newsletters, maybe some fitness plans. You just connect your account to the app, Rocket Money finds the recurring subscription fees, and then you can easily cancel them from the app. It's a really cool, cool service. They also have a service that can help you lower your bill. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. That's a lot of money. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
That connectivity was much stronger after that practice. So this practice has measurable effects on the connectivity of key regions of our brain. And I think that it's just like going to the gym. Like if you don't practice it, it's going to atrophy. Those skills are going to atrophy. If you go back and tried it right now, you probably wouldn't do as well. But if we gave you another 4-month booster session or something, you could probably get back up there. So these things are both relatively stable, but are also amenable to change. That's my nuanced answer.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. If you made a goal for yourself to read the great books of the Western world, but have had trouble following through with it, check out Online Great Books. It's an online platform. You sign up. They're going to mail you a physical copy of the book you're going to read. So if you're reading Republic that month, they're going to send you a physical copy of Plato's Republic. You're going to read it. They're going to give you a reading schedule, send you reminders so you keep pace with your reading. You'll be assigned to a class where you can discuss the book in the form. And at the end of the month, you'll have a video seminar where you can talk about this in real time. It's a great way. You have accountability. Plus, you have someone to talk to about this stuff and sort through this and think through it. So if you'd like to check this out, go over to onlinegreatbooks.com. And when you're ready to sign up, use code AOM at checkout to save 25% off your first 3 months. Again, onlinegreatbooks.com, code AOM at checkout to save 25% off your first 3 months. And now back to the show.
That's a good one. And yeah, you bring up brain training because that's kind of controversial too. It's
very
like, it's, you know, okay, yeah, you can improve working memory, but like, you know, like basically the arguments it seems like, yeah, you can do these games and you'll get better at that game. But does it like correlate to like improvement?
Does that transfer?
Yeah.
And the question is, so if you view IQ as smarts, which, you know, that I don't equate it with smarts. But if you do, which a lot of intelligence researchers do, then they'll say, you're just improving your working memory. You're not improving your smarts.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's a slippery slope. I think that, say that to a lot of people who suffer from their inability to focus, like people with ADHD. And if you show them, go through training and you show them benefits in their ability to concentrate in their daily life, that's a very meaningful improvement in itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what does that mean? Their intelligence wasn't improved just because their IQ score didn't budge? You know, in certain ways, I would count that as an improvement of intelligence.
Yeah.
But
that, man,
yeah, it becomes definitional.
That's really interesting. You know, one problem you talk about in the book with IQ tests is that they can what they end up doing is they label people as either gifted or ungifted. That's what we do with an elementary school.
That's right.
And when these labels are applied in youth, they can, you know, basically they follow you for the rest of your life.
That's right.
And I think we all, you know, intuitively understand, okay, if you're labeled ungifted, how that's going to hurt you. But you also make an argument in your book that being labeled gifted can hurt as well. How so?
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's actually labeled. I don't know if ungifted is an official label.
Yeah, what would you call it? Normal?
What do you say?
Just like normal, average, what would you?
No, there is a term that is official that is used called slow learner.
Oh.
Which I find extremely derogatory. And the slow learners are considered beyond hope. So they're not low enough in IQ to warrant a diagnosis of mental disability, but they're not high enough where we say that they are capable of remediation. So they fall between the cracks. That's the 80 to 90 or the 70 to 80 IQ range. They're slow learners.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the closest thing I would say to ungifted. But being labeled gifted does impact it. I think it sets up an unrealistic expectation of what it takes to succeed in life and what it takes to, particularly when you get to a point where you're going to face challenges. It sets up this expectation that you were somehow born with this special sauce that's going to get you through the hard times in life, that's going to get you to your goals, that's going to allow you to achieve no matter what. And I think it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous and not true. You know, there are clearly kids that are developmentally ahead of others, just as there are kids who are developmentally slower than others at any moment in time. And the resources they require, it does involve giving them more accelerated, you know, because I'm a fan of acceleration. Yeah. But beyond that, I think it's dangerous to set up for them expectations that that they hold around their head, this sort of fixed notion of ability as you're either gifted or you're not gifted, because the reality is far more complicated than that.
So I guess a disadvantage of being called gifted. I mean, you sort of lose out on those opportunities of like learning grit and, cause you sort of like, it's sort of learned helplessness, right? It's like, okay, if I can't get it right off the bat, then I shouldn't even try. Cause apparently I wasn't born to do that. I mean,
that's right. I mean, that's a very common finding. Most kids in special education is they acquire learned helplessness. And that's a shame. There's a lot of debate amongst the gifted community about what the purpose of gifted education should be, and I think that that's far from settled. You know, is giftedness who you are, or is giftedness what you do? And the field is divided on that issue. And if you believe giftedness is who you are, then nothing you do is really going to matter, really. If giftedness is who you are and say, I'm gifted, and then you fail at something, well, that can have a dramatic impact on a person's self-esteem and motivation to keep going, because they'll say, oh, I guess I wasn't gifted to begin with, you know?
Yeah.
So that can work in different ways as well.
So do you think we should just drop the labels completely?
I'm okay for dropping it. Yeah. I just wrote a op-ed that we just submitted in the New York Times. We'll see what happens with some other researchers who wrote a very thoughtful book on on rethinking gifted education. And, you know, we argue that gifted education shouldn't be about identifying the gifted kid and giving them resources. It should be about advanced academics. Yeah. It should be more about the gifted curriculum and not the gifted person.
Mm.
So we think it gets in the way of the everyday practical needs of the child in the classroom. The giftedness concept and label, I feel, gets in the way of the real issues, which is the individual needs of each child in that classroom. And you are going to have some students in any classroom that at any moment in time require more advanced academics.
Mm-hmm.
But sticking the giftedness label, I think, gets in the way of how to actually help them with what they need most, which is normally just advanced academics within a particular domain, not in general, not in every single way possible, but usually in very specific ways. You know, the kid who's a math whiz and needs more math curriculum, you know, like, let's give him advanced academics in math. But I'm very more an advocate of a very practical approach, a very needs-based approach, but not getting tripped up in these fixed labels.
Interesting. I'm curious if things like Khan Academy and online education will make that practical. Because I'm sure, like, right now people are like, it's easier just to like segment these kids off into their own separate class. But I guess with online education, you don't have to do that so much.
That's right. And you also let kids go at their own pace.
Yeah.
And, you know, the giftedness concept is all about how fast do you get there. You know, if you're getting there faster than others, you're gifted. If you're getting there slower than others, you're ungifted. But, you know, I think that really is not thinking about it the right way. It's not really conducive to getting the best out of these kids. If there's an emphasis instead, if we had more of an emphasis or a school culture on the process,
mm-hmm.
and not so much on how fast you get there, but the quality of what you're producing, if there's more of an emphasis on that, I think you'd be getting a lot more performance, better performance out of all the students.
Very interesting. Okay, so another big theme in your book is this idea of greatness, like, you know, achieving greatness. And that's, I guess, the first question would be, like, how do you define greatness? Like, what is it? Like, how do you define it? Because I'm sure, like, it's going to be different for every person, right?
Yeah, now that we've sorted out intelligence.
Yeah, let's go to this other complex, contentious topic.
You know, greatness is such a loaded word. Other people have used other words that, basically what I'm talking about there is about world-class expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, you know, high achievement at a level in which you, clearly, have acquired so much knowledge in that field, and maybe you even you kind of sit on top of it. You're kind of change it or see it in new ways or steer it in new directions. Like, you're influencing it. To me, I think that's what greatness really is your ability to kind of pull a whole field or pull a whole where people are like following, you know, in new directions. But it does require a certain amount of expertise to do that. So there's a certain process to that. I know that you've excerpted, I think, one of Robert Greene's books, Mastery.
Mastery, yeah.
You know, I think that he what he calls mastery might be what I'm calling greatness.
Okay.
You know, but it is, there's no objective definition of what greatness is. What do you think greatness is? Everyone, I think, thinks of greatness in a different way, probably.
Yeah, I mean, well, after I read your book, I was like, oh, that's a great, I like that idea of greatness. I mean, to me, greatness is like being excellent in some aspect of your life. That's to me what greatness is. Whether that's sports or music or relationships, I'm not talking just about picking up chicks, but like just like being, having that social intelligence, being adept at that. To me, I guess that would be greatness.
Yeah, I would be totally on board with that. I don't want to get too tripped up on the terms, mm-hmm. But there clearly is a characteristic. You know, you kind of like know greatness when you see it.
Yeah.
know, or you know when you've achieved it, like you know that you've kind of gotten to a level that's top of the curve, like top 1% compared to other people in that field or in that whatever you're interested in.
So, yeah. I mean, to achieve, you know, greatness or excellence, or whatever you want to call it, I mean, besides expertise, right?
I mean, that's right.
I'd imagine there's other attributes you need. And it's not just intelligence either. You can be very, I mean, I know extremely smart people who just have wasted their smart, you know, their smarts because they lack certain, you know, certain attributes that would allow them to take advantage of that.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why I like to think of greatness as a multiplicative function of a wide range of characteristics, not an additive function. So if greatness was just the sum of grit and IQ and curiosity and, you know, then that wouldn't allow for your ability to compensate in various ways mm-hmm. to reach the same goal, because you would just add these values up and your total value would be the summation of them. But instead, I see them more as a multiplicative function. So a very high level of certain characteristic can give you a higher total product value than another one, because these things multiply among each other. Gotcha. And in the book, I outline a lot of different characteristics that you can bring to the table that we should be considering as potential contributors to greatness. Things like growth mindset, self-regulation, deliberate practice, which is certainly something that is extremely important. That's sort of the quality or the way that you learn. Active learning strategies, not being a passive learner, but actively seeking out mentors, actively seeking out knowledge, and sort of making that a very active learning process. I think openness to experience is very important. Intellectual curiosity. I've distinguished intellectual curiosity in my own research from IQ. Mm-hmm. They're separate dimensions. So you can be a very fast information processor and not have much curiosity. And the other way around. And I think these things – the point I want to make is that you can mix and match all these characteristics in unique ways to kind of give you your own brand of intelligence, your own unique – your unique aspect of intelligence that you bring to the table that you wouldn't appreciate if we just solely stuck to the standardized model. You know, if we just took one of these characteristics like IQ and said, you know, the extent to which you deviate from this number is the extent to which you deviate from intelligence, or the extent to which the extent to which you deviate from your ability to be great. You know, I don't think that's the right way of thinking about it.
Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong. So what I'm understanding is like you could score low on an IQ test or be considered a slow learner.
Uh-huh.
But if you have these other attributes or some of them or a mixture of them,
yes.
You might take you a little bit longer to get that point, but you could eventually get there if you stick to it. Is that
kind of? There's no, God didn't put any limits to saying like, oh, that you must have IQ above this number to be great in life.
Yeah.
You know, there's no commandments from above like that. A lot of time we self-impose limitations, and our own perceived limitations are often incorrect. And I think that's what that's just what I noticed in myself so clearly, is just how many limiting notions I had about that. I was being fed all these notions about how intelligent I was. And once I kind of tested those limits, I realized just how wrong they were. And I think, you know, more people need to be doing that with themselves.
Very interesting stuff. I think we're running out of time here, but I got one last question for you.
You're asking me really great questions.
Well, I mean, it's just really, it's fascinating stuff. I mean, here, let me get to this question. Okay. You devoted a chapter to deliberate practice, right? You talk about that's one of those attributes you need to achieve mastery or greatness. I think we've written about it. I think people are kind of pretty familiar with it now. This whole idea of like, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's the 10,000 hour rule and, you know, whatever. But you sort of take a nuanced view on it, conception of it. I mean, can you explain where your ideas like differ from the typical idea of deliberate practice?
Yeah, I don't think that I differ too much from the traditional notions. Why were you thinking I differ from the, you mean like Erickson's notion?
It was just, it seemed like it was a little more nuanced because like, I think the popular idea of deliberate practice out there is like, okay, if you just devote 10,000 hours to this
or like, okay, cool,
then like you're going to become a golf pro, which.
So, okay. So there are the rule, the 10,000 hour rule, I think is we have to understand it's just an average.
Okay.
There are people that get there in 2 years and there are those that takes 20 years, right? Let's get away from the rule idea. The kind of practice you put into it, you know, what Anders Ericsson has called deliberate practice is a sort of quality of practice, which is clearly important. But that kind of practice interacts, I believe it interacts with a wide range of other variables, like your levels of motivation, your the extent to which you're at the appropriate challenging yourself so that you can enter that flow state, the environmental support, how much are people giving me the resources, how much are people, do you feel as though you're in a supportive, belonging environment? I see deliberate practice as something that, you know, the rate at which you go up that curve, the rate at which you learn things differs from different people.
Okay.
And the amount of time it takes you to get there, you know, differs greatly, but it differs depending on a wide range of personal characteristics and environmental characteristics. So I think we just need to be careful of just saying 10,000 hour rule,
yeah,
because it really is not a rule, and there is no magic number to this. And I think that when you get rid of the magic number idea, it allows you to acknowledge there are prodigies and there are also late bloomers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. You know, the world has lots of different kinds of people, and I'm okay with embracing that messiness and embracing that. It's not messiness; it's just human diversity, and I'm okay with that. You know,
very good. Well, the 10,000 hour rule that sells books.
It does. It's a simple idea.
They're like, oh wow, that's awesome. I can do that. As a dad, and I know there's a lot of dads or soon to be dads out there, their parents, and like a lot of modern dads, they're much more involved in their kids' life.
Yeah.
Are there specific things that we can be doing with our kids to encourage these skills and attributes that are necessary to achieve greatness in their own way, whatever that is?
Absolutely. At the end of the day, that's where my whole research is going. That's what really I'm passionate about the most, is how can we as teachers and parents bring out the best in our child? Because I think it's all we can ask for at the end of the day. You know, we get tripped up with all these words and we're afraid, oh, Johnny's not progressing as fast as Jimmy down the street,
yeah,
you know. And if we just stop with the comparisons, stop with that whole paradigm of individual differences where we say, oh, my child's not progressing as fast a rate as that child. Stay at a very local, stay at a very needs-based, what does my child need at this exact moment? And there are things that you can do to bring out the best in that child to make them motivated. You can, I think we should listen to their daydreams, listen to their own, what are their thoughts, what are they dreaming about, what are their, that gives us clues to their passions and their proclivities. I think we should instill in our children the value of hard work, instill in them the idea that they will see results if they put in that work, that there is this sort of, Carol Dweck calls it a growth mindset,
yeah,
that there's value to learning from feedback and there's no state labeled failure. You know, don't ever say to your child, like, you failed, you know, in this moment. You know, really try to instill in them this growth mindset. Set up the conditions that allow them to play, set up the conditions that allow them to question authority. And I would say ultimately the thing I've learned the most about my whole life is the importance of being your own self-advocate. And what I mean by being your own self-advocate is insulating yourself from the expectations of others, kind of creating the bubble around that so that you are totally operating with your own internal compass. And that's probably the number one thing I see among those who do reach greatness, is that they've done a really good job following their own internal compass and kind of ignoring that sort of that outside expectations and influences.
Very cool. What about guys who are like in their 20s or 30s, or I mean, even if they're 50s, like they feel like they've sort of like missed out, right? They're not on that path. I mean, can you turn things around? I guess is the question. I mean, are you, if you haven't started this now, are you doomed to a life of mediocrity? Is that the question?
Come on. Definitely not. Like I did this piece on late bloomers for Psychology Today a couple years ago, and I had the great privilege of interviewing a bunch of late bloomers in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who completely changed careers. And what struck me about that is that they were able to use that their age to their advantage. So it actually sometimes it's to your benefit to be a late bloomer. Mm. Because you can bypass all the games people play, all the bullshit, you know, all the competition and everything amongst the younger people. You can just glide right over it all and get your own unique niche in the marketplace. I've seen that in this guy who got on Broadway at age 50, I think. And you know, he just, you know, all these kids that are vying for the same spots right outside of drama school at age like 22 when they just graduate, he just walked right over that, right?
Yeah.
And you can see it in lots of different fields. I would definitely not lose hope, and I would try to think strategically of ways of using it to your advantage. In fact,
very cool. All right, well, Scott, this as always, fascinating discussion. Book Ungifted, completely a great book. If you're a dad, go get it. Even if you're not a dad, highly recommend you'll get it because you'll get something. I got something out of it for my own life. So, thanks again for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Brett. I really appreciate the work you do.
Thank you. Our guest today was Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. Scott is the author of the book Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, and you can find that on Amazon.com. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this free podcast, we would really appreciate it if you take the time to give it a rating on whatever service you use to listen to podcasts, be it iTunes or Stitcher. That would help us out a lot. And until next time, stay manly.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.